So we had some highlights from this race. One of them would be the jury. The jury made decisions that affected the race and the outcome. And honestly, we haven't seen such a racially fogged jury since maybe the O.J. Simpson trial. I mean, if you were a Frenchman in this race and you did some ill will, likely you weren't punished. Between Two Wheels podcast. This is your host, Tyler Yonke. On today's episode, I'm going to be discussing the 2017 Tour de France. I know you're missing your fix. You got used to every morning in July, waking up, a little something, a little Tour de France. Now it feels like maybe your girlfriend left you. There's no coffee grounds in the coffee machine. Something's just a little off. I, too, am feeling that way. So I also wanted to just do a little recap, give a little summary of what I thought with some of the fun issues, the things to discuss from the tour, give you a little historical perspective on a few things, and just I just miss it, so just kind of wanted to go over it. All right, in case you're living under a rock, you probably already know these things, but I'm just going to give a recap of some of the winners of the different categories, and then we could talk about some of the issues that went along with those. So obviously, Chris Froome won his fourth Tour de France, Great Britain rider from Team Sky. Very narrow victory over Cannondale Drapac's Rigoberto Urán of Colombia. Then he had Romain Bardet in third. Rides for AG2R. He's a Frenchman. Haven't had too many French on the podium lately. He was last year, but since before him, you know, you're going back quite a while. He was 220 down. Then just a 1 second behind him for fourth place was Sky teammate of Chris Froome, Mikel Landa from Spain. Very close race down to these four riders coming into the last second to last stage time trial. We'll discuss that a little bit later. Then they have the sprinters jersey. It's a green jersey. The sprinters, the points race kind of throughout. You have different sprints points, and then they get points for the overall stage results. Michael Matthews of Australia for Giant Sunweb, he ended up winning two stages in the race himself and the green jersey. Then his teammate, Warren Barguil from France, also for Giant Sunweb, as I mentioned, he won the polka dots, the climber's jersey. He also won two stages. And as a Frenchman, he also won on Bastille Day, which is like French Independence Day. It was kind of a big deal for him and his country. The young riders jersey, it's anyone under the age of 25. Simon Yates for Orica Scott, Australian team. He's from Great Britain, rides for an Australian team. He's a twin brother of Adam Yates, who also won the same jersey last year's Tour de France as well. It'll be interesting to see when those two decide to pair up on the on a Grand Tour sometime and go at it. You know, they also have a teammate, Esteban Chavez, who was, I believe, second in last year's Tour of Spain. He's also been second, I believe, or third in the Tour of Italy. So he's an up-and-comer. Did not have a good Tour de France, but he had some injuries and kind of came into it late this year. The last award that they had, well, there's two other ones. There was a Super Combativity Award. It's kind of the most aggressive rider. They award that every day throughout the tour. And the winner this year, then they do a super one, which was the overall for the entire race, who's the most combative, aggressive rider. And Warren Barguil won that. He also won the polka dots jersey. And the person in seventh place was Thomas de Gendt. That's a little controversy, and we will go over that a little later because that's an interesting little interesting tidbit to discuss. So this was one of the most, it wasn't the smallest margin of victory ever, but it was a narrow one. And the top three riders heading into the final few stages. This is the closest that the race has ever been coming up to the end. And I know the Tour de France organizers were trying to set it up that way. They did so by having not as many summit finishes. You'd go over one of these big Grand Tour climbs or category climbs, and then you would descend down maybe another 20K to the finish. And it just kind of nullified some of the racing. So guys like, hey, well, I'm 5K from the top of a climb. I'm not going to, you know, drill it and try to drop everybody because everything's just going to come back together on the descent. So it resulted in tighter race overall, more suspense. But did it end up maybe making the race a little more, I want to say flat, because not in vertical distance, but just kind of blasé. There's yes and no. I enjoyed a lot of the tour. It wasn't a lopsided win. We've had some of the more narrow races over the years. I'm going to just run through some of those so you get a perspective of kind of where they're at. You know, Lance Armstrong was winning. I know he technically hasn't won, but, you know, there'd be 5, 7, 10 minutes. There was other races that have been, you know, 15 plus. But here's some of the closer races that we've had. The most famous one, 1989, Greg LeMond, 8 seconds over Laurent Fignon, a Frenchman. That was one on the final day. If you ever get a chance to just kind of see that race on YouTube, it is pretty fascinating to watch. Especially that one was transformative in the fact that he used his time trial bars in that time trial. And, you know, there, I remember technical breakdowns of Fignon's not wearing a helmet, his ponytail's dragging, he's not in aero bars, and it was a short time trial, and Greg LeMond overcomes 50 seconds, beats him by 58 seconds on the day, and actually overcomes and wins the overall tour by 8 seconds. So after, you know, roughly 2,000 miles of racing, comes down to 8 seconds. It's pretty phenomenal. 2007, Contador wins over, and I'm only going back over the last 40 years or so, Contador over Cadel Evans by 23 seconds. 1987, Stephen Roach, 40 seconds over Pedro Delgado. I'd like to get into the 87 Tour de France someday. It's got some fascinating statistics to it, and actually just a dramatic race in general. I will drop back and talk about that a little bit later. 1977, Bernard Thévenet, 48 seconds over Henny Kuyper of Netherlands. Thévenet was from France, so you see we used to have French winners. 2017, this one, 54 seconds over Iran. Carlos Sastre in 2008, 58 seconds over Cadel Evans. And then, so you're looking at the top six ones, it's all within a minute. Then 2006, which, I mean, you can't even decipher this one, because Floyd Landis initially provisionally won a minute three over Oscar Pereiro, but then Pereiro was only 32 seconds over Andreas Klöden when Flandis gets DQ'd. But, you know, Pereiro was a teammate of Landis, and according to Landis, he was doping too. So who really won that one? So let's just drop that one out. And then in about the eighth one, you have 2015 Chris Froome, a minute 12 over Nairo Quintana. So you've got, you know, a lot of tours close together on time, and those, I could look back at a lot of these ones with some, there's some excitement, and definitely some interesting, some wins there. So we'll, Chris Froome win more. I mean, he's won four already. And if you look back in the statistics, no one has stopped at four. They've either won three, or they've won five, or they've been disqualified from winning seven. But no one's ever just stopped at four. So it will be interesting to see if Chris Froome is the one that's been able to hang on. You know, the one stage in the tour, I'm not remembering which one it was, except for the Romain Bardet one at that day, where it's a steep pitch to the finish. I mean, I was hearing all kinds of things about, is Chris Froome over? Is this his swan song? You know, now he's done. We're seeing the demise. This is a 95 or 94 when Miguel Indurain was dropped by Jan Ullrich, and he was never to be seen again. You know, finishes outside the tour. You know, same with Greg LeMond, and was it 91? Chris Froome ended up winning, obviously. So what are those other people? Well, you have... Do we even say this? You have Lance Armstrong, 7 wins. He's been DQ'd of those, so I guess we could put him out of memory. Although they're still fun to watch if you just want to do it for a spectacle. It's kind of like the good old days of watching a Rocky movie where you and that's the difference you see now from then. Is you watch a tour stage now and these guys, they'll hit each other and they'll kind of come back to it, and then another guy attacks, and then the band stretches and they're, you know, not a lot of hitting. Whereas you watch back in the Lance Armstrong days, and there's definitely a comical stage. I'm trying to remember which tour it was, but they're going up Alpe d'Huez. This is where Tyler Hamilton has a broken collarbone. And these guys are just, it's the Rocky movie. Just, you know, 12 rounds of slaughtering each other and still just hitting and hitting and hitting. And that's what these guys were doing. They were just attacking, attacking, attacking. And it was phenomenal to watch. But, you know, it was fueled. It was, as the movie now, Tour de Pharmacy. That's kind of what you're looking at. Anyway, your 5-time Tour de France winners in the past. You've got Eddy Merckx winning in 69 to 72, and then again in 74. Jacques Anquetil from France, 57, 1957, 61 to 64. You know, a lot of these guys have successive years. You know, Chris Froome has won, what, three in a row now. It is interesting, though, you see like Bernard Hinault, Frenchman, 78, 79, 2 years in a row, skips, has an 81, 82, skips out to 85. He had some injuries in there. And then, you know, he won again in 85 and then 86, you know, the one of the greatest tours battled against with Greg LeMond. And then you got Miguel Indurain winning from 91 to 95, straight through victories. Phenomenal to watch as well. Actually somewhat boring to me in a sense because I like to see those spunky climbers, you know, attacking and the Marco Pantani type. And he would just slug his way, big gear, destroy everyone in a time trial, and then just, you know, hang on. And somewhat boring in that sense. But anyway, that's what we have, five-time winners. Like I said, Chris Froome is only four-time winner. And we'll see if he'll make it to five. But he won in 2013, then straight from 15 to 17. He got three-time winners, Greg LeMond, 86, 89, and 90. 86 was one of the most phenomenal races. 89 was interesting for the fact that he wasn't expected. He had been, you know, shot, came back. He had done really poorly in the Tour of Italy that year. Kind of found out he had like an iron deficiency and they were hoping to kind of cure that up. And then he came good in the Tour and just, you know, took everyone by surprise in the opening time trial and then just kind of kept at it. But the 1990 Tour was really interesting for the fact that he gave away a huge lead at the beginning and then just picked his way off minute by minute, stage by stage, never winning an actual stage of that tour. And it was maybe one of his most impressive just for the way that he kept coming and coming and coming at him. Then you got Philippe Thys, some Belgian guy from the early 1300, 1913, 14, and 1920. Louison Bobet is another famous guy. Him and Jacques Anquetil kind of battling it out there, 53, 54, and 55. So we had some highlights from this race. One of them would be the jury. The jury made decisions that affected the race and the outcome. And honestly, we haven't seen such a racially fogged jury since maybe the O.J. Simpson trial. I mean, if you were a Frenchman in this race and you did some ill will, likely you weren't punished. We had the Sagan, Mark Cavendish collision wreck where Peter Sagan gets DQ'd. Mark Cavendish gets crashed out. And in that same race, and I mentioned this in the podcast first episode, Demar, who actually won that race, swerved and cut across Bahani's wheel really bad. And there was no decision by the jury. Instead, they decided to DQ Mark Cavendish. But then we've also had one where Bahani was striking out. I think he hit Jack Bauer during one of the stages. He was relegated to last place and given a 1 minute penalty. But for a guy that's a sprinter who doesn't care about the overall general classification, a 1 minute penalty means absolutely nothing. But he's a Frenchman, so they weren't going to kick him out. Then we had the bottle gate, which affected the final outcome. What you had was a climbing stage. You had George Bennett, a New Zealand guy. He takes a bottle inside the last 20K. At the same time, Romain Bardet takes a bottle inside the 20K, a Frenchman. And just I think a mile or two before or after that, Rigoberto Urán took a bottle inside the last 20K. George Bennett, Urán were both penalized 20 seconds, and Romain Bardet was not penalized at all. There was a big stink about it, and the jury was going back and forth about, well, you can't take it from a team. Oh, you can't take it from anybody. But then they were able to show that as George Bennett's taking a bottle, Urán's taking a bottle. I mean, Bardet's taking a bottle as well. Then they said, oh, well, you can't take a drink. Well, Bardet was taking a drink as well. So then what they decided to do, since he's French, is just basically say no penalty and everyone's fine. Now, that 20-second penalty did not, if you look at the overall standings, it didn't affect Urán. He still, you know, was down 54, and then there was plenty of space to third place. But Bardet, being 1 second, it would have made a difference to Mikel Landa. So that definitely saved the tour, at least the podium, for Romain Bardet of not having it. The ultimate decision, as I said, was no penalty for all three, but it would have affected the podium with Landa only being 1 second behind Bardet. Then you had another issue with Degenkolb, who punches Michael Matthews after, Bling is his nickname, wins the stage, and there's no expulsion. I don't even know if he got relegated. I didn't really hear much more about that. Now, he's not French, so that kind of goes my whole theory. But once again, it's just a lack of concrete decisions by the jury. Then lastly, we have the Supercombativity Award, which I had mentioned at the top here, with Thomas DeGent, gets second place. He had spent, Thomas DeGent spent, I think he's Belgium, he had spent over 1,000 kilometers in a breakaway during the 2017 Tour de France, and he wasn't awarded the Supercombativity Award. Warren Barguil was. But Barguil was also won outright the best climber's jersey. So it's kind of a dichotomy of like, well, you're going to award him that, but then you also give him the aggressive rider award when the aggressive rider award isn't about winning those other things. I mean, it's kind of what Thomas De Gendt was doing, which was being off the front and being aggressive. But he wasn't French, and a French rider won it. So that was an issue with the jury. Another biggest event that happened was Richie Porte crashing out. And was that due to having these nullified climbs and then having the sprint finishes, you know, down the 20K after the that's kind of what they were looking for. And Dan Martin had made a comment afterwards because he was involved in this wreck where a stage 9 crash took out probably the best challenger to Froome overall. Because Richie Porte can time trial, he can climb. He's probably one of the most pure, best climbers in the world. And he was obviously appearing very strong at the time. But Dan Martin, another guy who was affected in the crash, said, hey, you know, the tour organizers got what they wanted, which is, you know, excitement. I don't know if that's really the case and what they didn't obviously want a rider to crash out. But they did have it did actually make a big outcome to the race having that wreck. The wreck also took on, as I said, Dan Martin, and he lost over a minute 30 that day. And the crash caused him to have some substantial pain. He wasn't able to stand up. And what you saw, though, you know, you can't do it. Maybe it's the butterfly effect where, you know, one little thing can affect everything else. So, well, Dan Martin lost a minute 30 that day, and then he was able to slowly make some time up. Then he lost some time again, you know, on some flat stages. They probably race differently had he not wrecked. So you don't necessarily give him any leash. So, you know, you can him and haw about what that crash did, but, you know, the racing still continues. And that was a big outcome, a big issue in the race. The stage 1 time trial in the rain was also a big deal because Froome, if you look at Iran, who never really attacked him, actually made up time on him. If you look at all the stages besides the first time trial and then stage 20 time trial, Iran actually made more time than Froome did. So he actually had a better overall race barring those two time trials. The first time trial actually is rumored, Iran lost a minute 3 to Garrett Thomas, the winner. So he lost right around the 50-second margin to Chris Froome as well. And the rumor had it that Iran had a bike issue, and his TT bike was actually determined to be illegal by the UCI, and he had to use his regular bike. I haven't been able to confirm that. I heard that, read that somewhere, that supposedly that was a valid story. I didn't even be able to see it on video, but that would make a big difference, obviously, if you're riding your regular bike, especially when, you know, Sky is determined with these skin suits. They had like some panels, some, I don't know, something on them, and there was a question whether those were legal, and one of the French teams was even claiming that it was giving them a 20-second advantage. So if you think of just a skin suit giving you about a 20-second advantage, what do you think a time trial bike does over just your regular wide-barred, handlebarred bike? Alejandro Valverde also crashed out in the stage 1 time trial. You know, it could actually end his career. He cracked his kneecap, and at his age, which is 35+, who knows what that's he's going to be able to do. You know, I read after this, Peter Stetna, who rides for the Trek Segafredo team and had that similar crash and injury several years ago, says, you know, it's still affecting him, and he's a young guy. Another good highlight of the race was Peter Sagan's stage 3 win, and the way he came about and was able to take the win. He was expected to win possibly 5 stages during the tour until he got DQ'd, but he was able to win the stage 3, which looked like he was then going to be hurtling himself onto multiple stage wins, but had a kick up to the finish, and he was able to come around. It looked like he was going to take the lead, and then he pulls his foot out of the pedal. He still has time to pop it back in and kick for the finish and still come across with his being able to post up. So pretty impressive. Then, of course, the next day he ends up with a a big crash with Cavendish and they both go out, which I discussed a little bit earlier. You know, at first blush, looking at that race, you look at the before you look at it in slow motion, my reaction is, oh my God, crap. You know, look at, he's elbowing the guy and they're getting, he's obviously should be kicked out. But you look at it in closer and, you know, the elbow did not affect the race. So it was actually it's sad for the fact that here's one of the biggest names, one of the biggest flares of cycling out there, a highlight of Peter Sagan, you know, on and off the bike. And then he's basically kicked out of the tour, which, you know, the sport could obviously go for some excitement. I understand where the tour is going to say they're going to lay down the law no matter who's involved. But when the law is so tangible and moldable, it's hard to be able to kind of be in line with what their decision was. Marcel Kittel winning five stages, then having to slowly get the sprints points taken away by Michael Matthews. You know, when Kittel finally crashed out and relinquished his lead on the green points jersey to Michael Matthews, Matthews had come within 9 points that day. So he was obviously putting in a good effort and a great challenge. I think Kittel probably would have won the last stage of the tour into Paris, but we'll never know because he didn't actually make it there. But five stage wins was obviously very impressive. Giant Sunweb was another highlight. The team itself, two stage wins with Michael Matthews, two more with Barguil, plus the green points jersey, the polka dots jersey. And in addition to Barguil having a heartbreaking photo finish to second, Matthews also had several top fives and top tens. I think Barguil actually was able to also sneak into the top 10. So for Giant Sunweb, it was definitely a very successful tour. Speaking of the photo finishes, Warren Barguil on stage 9, very close loss to Rigoberto Urán, who was basically riding in a fixed gear. And then you had Ed van Bogenhausen on stage 7, just barely missing out to Kittel. Both were super close photo finishes. Yep, both later on were able to redeem themselves with very impressive wins. Edvald Bogenhausen was able to do it by launching himself with over less than 2K to go in a breakaway. He was already in a break, and then he soloed to the finish. And Barguil just went nuts on the climbing stages, eventually winning on Bastille Day, which was a very impressive day to win. That's French Independence Day. Some of the lows that we had from the tour were the results of Bahrain Merida team and the Cofidis team. If you just look at the overall spread of money earned on the tour by each team, Bahrain Merida ended up with just under 20,000 euros, 19,960, where Cofidis was 19,230. In comparison, is Team Sky with 716,590. So you've got a big discrepancy there. Bahrain brought basically nobody. Maybe Yanni Brakovic was the only guy that could contend. Even then, Sonny Cambrelli, was he on that team? I don't know. They just had nobody. Another disappointment was BMC and Movistar. They both had, you know, riders that could have contended, Nairo and Richie Porte, but one crashed out, Richie, the other being Nairo, who just was flat. And Alejandro Valverde, obviously a movie star that crashed out as well. But movie star had $24,000 euros and no results, whereas BMC had $59,000. And they had a close by Greg Van Avermaet to Sagan on the day he pulled his pedal out, stage 3. So obviously some disappointments for those two teams. But with the top two teams being Sky with over 700,000, then the second place, Cannondale Drapac at 243. So that's a huge discrepancy from first to second on money. So another thing Team Sky did actually get, though, was the team prize. So they won the team prize as well as the overall GC and guy in fourth place. I don't know if they had any stage wins besides the time trial on stage 1. So anyway, pretty good for them. While the money discrepancy seems outlandish, the reality is that Cannondale Drapac is one of the smallest budget teams around, while Sky is the biggest budget. So the fact that Cannondale Drapac was actually able to come in second on that is actually pretty impressive for them. And then you have BMC and Movistar, who both are big budget teams with no results to speak of. So yes, a good budget does help your team, as Sky showed, but it does suddenly mean you can't compete, as Drapac was showed. So you also had some other impressive disappointments, I'm sorry, were Nairo Quintana, his whole entire tour, he just was lackluster. I think he was in the top 15 maybe. That combativity award issue. And Roman Bardet's stage 20 time trial. He reminded me of Rasmussen back in the late 2000s, 2007, was it? Where he was in the time trial, he fell like two or three times in the final time trial. Looked really unorthodox, unnatural on a bike almost. One other big issue that came about was booing of Chris Froome on stage 20. This was before and while he was on the podium, not to mention when he was on the start ramp and coming out. I mean, we've heard about the ugly American before, but I can't imagine hearing boos that loud at a race like the Tour de France or any other American race for a foreign rider who was actually winning at the time. While the backlash on Twitter and the internet seemed to kind of absolve the French for their vigorous partisan behavior, and they compared it to their football, soccer matches, saying, oh, it's, you know, this is what we do. We are very combative and in supporting our teams. It does seem a bit far-flung to give the French a complete pass on their behavior at this point. Keep in mind that just 2 years ago, it was alleged by Froome that the fans were throwing bottles of urine at him and his team. And also remember that Chris Froome, by all accounts, is super courteous. He's humble. He's not a jerk at all to the French public or the media. So with that in mind, I don't care that the French fans booed him, but also won't give him a crap what the French think of Americans and our culture either. As Kevin Kline once told an English lady in the movie A Fish Called Wanda, if it wasn't for America, you'd be the smallest effing province in the Russian Empire. It's kind of how I feel about that. Big deal. However, perhaps the French were just finally realizing that expectations of success can often make you feel more angry and disappointed when you're getting beat. They did, in fact, have a very successful tour. And while there's still no overall French winner since 1985 with Bernard Hinault, they are getting closer. So perhaps their expectations were coming up to the point where they felt like, you know what, now we can start booing people who are actually successful. Maybe they'll be booed soon. I don't know. French had five stage winners this year. They had Demar on stage 4, Lilian Kemeljan on stage 8, Romain Bardet on stage 12, and Warren Barguil had 13 in stage 18 as well. Very impressive. Finally, good to see actually the home country doing well. Maybe they just stop booing the other riders and I wouldn't care as much. Next year, the race will actually be reduced from 9 riders to 8. This will be interesting based on the fact that they want the race to be less controlled. They want to take away the power of teams like Sky. But this year, Geraint Thomas actually crashed early on. And so Team Sky was only riding with 8-man team in general. They were riding against other guys. Cannondale Drapac had 9 guys finish, yet they would only typically have one guy up in the lead group, which was Rigoberto Urán. So they still managed to win the team prize and actually held that category from start to finish, Team Sky, that is. So when you see the riders' teams being reduced to 8 next year, all you're really seeing is one less person getting a chance at their Grand Tour. These teams are actually going to, maybe they're going to field less of a overall employees, you know, have less people on the team simply for the fact that they aren't going to be able to ride 9 riders in the tour. So why bring, you know, why actually employ an extra rider or two during the season? One of the other things we had in the tour was this unwritten rules of attacking. This is the non-attacking of the yellow jersey while during mishaps. Froome had a mechanical on stage 9, and Fabio Aru attacked right under his arm as he was holding up actually to indicate that he was having some sort of mechanical problem and needed assistance from the car or the neutral support. It appeared actually that he had perhaps shifting problems, maybe electronic shifting, maybe his battery wasn't charged. This to me seems like a prime time that you'd still be able to attack him. Then again on stage 15, he got a flat, and while the race was hitting the bottom of the climb, and in the first instance, the race was completely ground to a halt as Aru sat up from his attack and no one basically would come along to help him. But in the stage 15 flat with Froome, the race was totally on at the time. The pace didn't stop, causing Froome to basically expend a lot of energy to regain himself to the front group by the top of the climb. But in both instances, the group didn't attack him as he rejoined, which they should have, and they had every right to do. This whole fiasco was brought about by a lot of discussions regarding the unwritten rules of cycling and not attacking the leader in those types of scenarios. the history books were referenced, and many discussed this Lance and Jan Ulrich issue in 2001, and then Lance again in 2003, where he was hit by a bystander's bag, and the race was basically neutralized until the leader got back in with the main group. However, personally, I think the race should be on, and having mechanicals is totally a part of racing, and it also emphasizes the importance of the team aspect of the race. Two quick historical perspectives of not waiting and that I wanted to point out from the 87 and the 1990 tour. The 1987 tour, which was won by Irishman and Dan Martin, by the way, his uncle, Stephen Roach. He had lost the lead to Francois Bernard up this infamous Mont Ventoux in the individual time trial. By the way, I'll have to do a little history recap of the 87 Tour, being that it's its 30th anniversary. But the race not only had an individual time trial up Ventoux, but an 87-kilometer, which is 54 miles, individual time trial. That's the total mile, and plus the total mileage of the race that year was 2,629, covering over 25 stages. Not just a three-week, so 3 week plus. They had, I think the second stage had a double day. You had an individual stage, and then you had a team time trial. Anyway, Jean-Francois Bernard took the lead on stage 18, as I mentioned, but he lost it the next day to Pedro Delgado after getting a flat, chasing on, and then having Delgado and Roach attack him in the feed zone. That's right, they attacked him in the feed zone, which is supposed to be one of these unwritten rules of things you should not do to a race leader. Jean-Francois Bernard later told Roach that he had made him lose the tour, so evidently he never really got over his getting the feed zone attack incident, and he never let it slide. Still felt slighted about that one. In 1990, Greg LeMond, much like Froome, had won the tour that year without winning an actual individual stage, but he had allowed this guy Claudio Chiappucci, who he kept calling like Cappucci and Cappuccino. It's pretty hilarious if you ever go back and watch the tour in any of those interviews at the time. He had no idea who this guy was, but he let him get over 10 minutes on stage one. Then slowly and slowly throughout the race, he was cutting into his lead until he finally was grinding it down. Going into stage 17, Greg was now only down by 5 seconds behind the Italian, with a looming stage 20, about a 45-kilometer time trial still ahead, which was likely to decide the outcome, and likely not in Claudio Chiappucci's favor. As I said, he was an unknown, but he had never done anything, even in the first time trial, to indicate that he should be able to hold on to that kind of lead. So 5 seconds seemed like Greg was going to be able to take this race to Paris. But during the stage 17, Greg got a flat, and it was a lumpy day. And during some of those lumpy sections of the road, when Greg got his flat, Chiappucci and his team just lit the race on fire. Greg had teammates who were up ahead in the road in the break, and they actually had to sit up to come back and help him. But they're not allowed to turn around and go backwards on the race, so they just sat there and they waited and waited as Chiappucci's group came flying through. And then finally they were able to get on with Greg, and they, by the end of the day, they saved his victory and put a victory in the balance that day, and were able to get Greg back up to the lead group. So those are times when the race, in its historical perspective, has shown that the race can be on. There's about these unwritten rules, guys attacking in the feed zone, attacking these leaders while they had mechanicals. Mechanicals is just part of the race. And while it's nice to kind of have some semblance of this gentleman's agreement, there's too many nuances of when there's appropriateness for that and when there's not. And, you know, they weren't waiting for Richie Porte. They weren't waiting for Dan Martin on stage 9, but they were waiting for Froome on multiple occasions. So I'd like to see that just be done away with at this point. So what do we have coming up next? Well, we're going to talk to some people about the Cascade Classic, and specifically the Cat 2 race and the UCI Men's Pro race there. We're going to go over some local races in town and in Northern California, and talk about kind of the interest of where cycling is at this point. There's several races that are being canceled, and how we can get involved and maybe bring the fertile ground of cycling back up. Another thing is the Tour of Utah, which is coming up, and it would be interesting to kind of give a breakdown of stages of that, and to see see where the local riders and with the Tour of California this year getting bumped up to a higher UCI level, as well as the Cascade Classic did, you saw some ramifications of both of those things come about. One is the Tour of California did not allow or did not have the ability to allow some of the continental teams into the race. So you had Action Berman, Hincapie team were not allowed to race where they have been able to before. So now Utah is even a greater pull for them, and to be able to display their good riders. And then the race in Cascade being bumped up to UCI level put so much strain that they didn't have several categories there. Along with it, actually looks like they may not be having that race anymore due to the strain and stress that it provided to the race organizers, and then some of the mishaps that happened the other day. So maybe we'll go through those. Thanks for tuning in.